Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny. Mina talks all things football with her unique brand of humor and insight. Her friends join each episode to talk about the NFL's latest storylines, along with her football-loving dog, Lenny, making frequent contributions. Follow The Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, baseball is back, and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with over 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNPlus.com/baseball. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is Foxworth Friday. Did the people like our tuxedos from the live show?
I hope so. I mean, actually, I don't care. I liked it.
Yeah.
You look outstanding. And I realized that I thought I was doing something when I got a purple tux. It's too dark. I need my tux to pop like your like shiny Diddy-esque shiny suit one or shiny silver one.
I had the Bobby Jones gospel joint. I got the blue velvet joint too. The blue velvet joint. I guess that thing gonna be hot as hell if I tried to wear that in the summer at some point.
I mean, we do a lot of like signaling to our personal success. Like as human beings, we do that, particularly like rap music. We all grew up with like finding ways to signal to people that you are doing well. I think having 2 stun-on-them tuxedos, like that should be a line in a rap song coming up. Because when I got 1 stun-on-them tuxedo, where it's like I got the normal black tuxedo at a certain point, which was a stunt in and of itself. Like the idea that you need to own a tuxedo, like suggests that you are moving in some pretty exclusive circles. And then you get from that to be like, you know what? I need a tuxedo that say, damn it, I'm here. And to need 2 tuxedos to say, damn it, I'm here. You are doing better than me, Bonnie Jones.
Yeah, I can't lie. I thought I was here when I got those tuxedos, but don't nobody be inviting me nowhere to wear them. And so I'm just like, what was I doing? And it's actually funny because I went to Jemele Hill's wedding now almost 2 years ago. And it was listed as formal, right? But people don't necessarily know what them terms mean. So I didn't think to break out the tux because I was like, man, ain't nobody really going to be out here in them tuxes, right? And then I got there and no sirree, Bob. They were all there ready for tux action. And I actually turned out to be underdressed.
Oh, my gosh. So formal is tux? I guess I always thought tux was black tie.
No. I don't know what exactly the difference between formal and but semi-formal is like when you get like nice suited up. That's the semi-formal. Okay. But see, that's the thing. I was assuming that people would think like you thought, right? And what I didn't want to do is be the one dude that's doing way too much out here in a tuxedo looking like the groom.
In most weddings, like there's certain weddings that you know when you go there that everybody is supposed to show up doing it. But most weddings, like that's not when you really want to stunt on them.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like everybody is just in the background. The bride is the only one who is stunting on them. But it sounds to me like Jemele's wedding was the type of wedding that I would love to be at.
Well, that's what I was about to say. What I underestimated was the preference of stunting of the invited crew that was there. They were like, oh man, now we got a chance to stunt, as opposed to me who looks at it like, damn, do I have to stunt? Like, is this a requirement for me? Do I have to stunt here? And so they was all stunted out. And so I was like, I got to get these tuxes on the road at some point. Like, lucky for me, my measurements don't really change. You know what I'm saying? Although, you know, I've been working out a little bit, you know?
Oh yeah. How did it?
A little snug. A little snug.
That's funny, because that's such a different feeling. I guess many guys and women is like, we go through this pandemic and so many of the women in my family and women that I know, not my wife, of course, not my wife,
never.
Many of them are finding out as we are starting to get to a place where they can outdoor dine, they're finding out that clothes don't quite fit the same. And it's not this type of pandemic blow up that you're experiencing. They experience it slightly differently. I guess a lot of dudes too.
Dog, let me tell you something. I got out of the shower a couple months ago and I took a step and I was like, are my thighs rubbing together a little bit? And I was so excited. Like, I was like, yeah, these leg workouts, they doing something. I'm the first person in the world to view my thighs are rubbing together with some measure of excitement.
I went in the reverse order. It's like, I've always like worked out, always been kind of muscular. So like, from the time I was like post puberty high school, like I had big quads and like the rest of my body was not like huge, but the quads was always abnormally big and rubbing together. Then I finally stopped playing football and started like studying and getting ready for GMAT and then like getting all my information for the job I had at the MBPA. And then like suddenly it's just a lot of wind just swishing through. It's just like they're not touching no boys. And it's like I don't look weird in the mirror, but you get used to seeing things a certain way. I'm like, man, I look emaciated.
Dog, man. Like, you guys have to understand, Dominique had a six-pack when he was 4 years old. I see the pictures. Like he was like that. I ain't gonna lie. If I have a kid and that kid comes out with a six-pack, I got bad news for him. It's about to be like he doing Chinese gymnastics, baby. We about to get this money.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I don't know. I think so much of it I learned as later in life where, like, because I always worked hard, I like thought my athleticism or speed or strength or body, the way my body looked was a result of my hard work. And then I stopped working hard and everything still like looks good enough. Like, oh, it's mostly genetics.
Yeah. You're like me staying skinny. I've actually been trying to work around this for quite a long time. And it's just not happening. I got my daddy's skinny jeans. Like, that's just that. Like, my brother on the other side, you've met my brother. Me and my brother are in entirely, we're about the same height, but we are in entirely different weight classes. Like, he's basically my mama's daddy. My granddaddy was one of them dudes that was 6'3", 270, but was born in 1909. So he was, like, the biggest dude anybody knew. My dad, on the other hand, had a 28-inch waist when he got married.
Wow. that's impressive and outstanding. I certainly remember just talking about the weight stuff since we're in draft season. I remember that being one of the big knocks on me is like, he's too small. And so I went to the combine and drank a gallon and a half of water before we had to weigh in. And I think I weighed in at like 187 or something like that. I was like, see, talk about who's too small. Then I promptly went to the bathroom and started throwing up. I remember it all came out. It came out the same way it went in. It didn't get digested at all. Like, it just was clear water. But you know what? Got that number right on that sheet.
You were just walking around with the equivalent of somebody pick up a gallon and a half of water and how much that weighs. And you were just like, it's like you strapped it to your stomach and got on the scale.
It's not like that. Exactly what it was. Because I went to the bathroom and immediately took that backpack right off and flushed it down the toilet. So, yeah, I wasn't the only one out there trying to fool people at that moment. That's what you're trying to do. That's what everyone's doing at a job interview. You're trying to trick your employer into believing, or your potential employer into believing, that you are better than you actually are.
Yeah, I told you, the combine to me, that's just like, it's taking the SAT, the ACT, the ASVAB, all the standardized tests at one time. And I brought up the ASVAB. I don't remember if I told you about this, but you know, that's the military test.
Yep.
And so they had us do the ASVAB in school once. And I asked him, like, what is this? You know, because I knew all the other tests that we were taking. I'm like, yo, what is this? It's the one to get into the military. And I ain't never put a stamp on something and mailed it in quite like that. Because the last thing I want to do is impress them. Right? The last thing I want them to think is we might have a star on our hands. No, you do not. You have no such thing.
Speaking of, like, culturals, like, signals that you are doing well, my son is really into the military, and he is like, and obviously we have all the issues that there are to have with it, and we try to talk to him about it, but he's 8 and he's a little boy, so he likes violence and he's into the military. And I remember growing up, my dad was in the Army. There's nothing I wanted less. Like, I had no desire to be a part of the white man's army. I mean, no disrespect to my dad. I love my dad to death. He did 20 years and it was a hell of a sacrifice. But what I was trying to explain to my son, because when we were talking to my son, like, it's okay to like this stuff. And if you are an adult, you want to join the military, that's fine. But like, there are other options. And we want to, like, this is why we've done all these things, to give you these other options. And he was like, so that means that you don't really like that Pops was in the military. I was like, why don't you go ask Pops why he joined the military? He was in a 2-bedroom with 8 kids in a neighborhood in Charlotte called The Rocks. Like, if Pops could have gone somewhere else or done something else, that's what Pops would have done. But Pops had to get out the house, and they wasn't really checking for guys with mediocre to not so great grades from the hoods of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Dude, how about this? My dad had the great grades, and he still wound up doing that four-year bid because they was poor. I had to start thinking about it when I go to my grandmama's house. He's from Odell, Louisiana. And all right, as I envision the house, you walk in, there's the living room, there's the sitting room, like the dining room of sorts, and then the kitchen. And then there's, I don't feel right calling it a master bedroom. You know what I'm saying? It ain't got its own bathroom. You know what I mean? So there's like the mat, like you come in and go to the left, there's the master bedroom. And then there's like two more rooms. They had 10 kids, dog. Like that's 12 people in that space. My dad told me, like, when I got to grad school, they helped me out, you know, getting mattresses and stuff like that. And I was thinking, I'm kind of grown, like, yo, man, I don't, you know, how I feel about my daddy, because my friends really just ain't had money like that. So like, I was the kid with money. And so I wouldn't say I was self-conscious about it, but I was always aware of the fact that, you know, you're supposed to be taking care of yourself at this point. My dad looked at me and said that when he was in graduate school, he shared a room with three other boys, and the room had two double beds.
Would they fight every night? They go to head to toe? Would
if I say head to foot is all that I can imagine in that scenario. And I say all that to say, I ain't have to go do this military thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was playing a game that was according to much different rules. And if I can't imagine what would have happened if I told my daddy at any age, I want to be in the military. Now, that wouldn't have lasted long.
Hove did that. So yes. Y'all have to go through.
Yes.
That's my whole feeling. It's funny because, like, and this might be, it's not uniquely Black phenomenon, but it's something that you feel in the Black community is there is a line of delineation, or at least for me and my family, and in my wife's family too, between before we started doing all right and after we started doing all right. And for my wife, her family was her grandfather. Like, her grandfather on her dad's side moved to DC and became like a number runner and did well. And then all his kids went to college, and all his kids are lawyers and doctors, and all their kids are the same thing. Prior to that, they was country po' folk. And the line of delineation in my family is like my parents, and it happened while I was growing up. So like, both my parents graduated from college while I was a kid. And like, they started a business and started to do well. And then I got to the league, and then everything changed. So my kids are looking at this like, this is life. And I'm like, you ain't got to go back far to see a couple generations before to where they wanted to do anything but go to the army. But you know what? They had no choice.
I now want to meet your father-in-law, because I had misunderstood what kind of bougie they were. Right. Oh, yeah. Like, I had and by the way, I do not use bougie as a pejorative term. I'm just talking about a man that bought you a Rolex when you graduated from one of them schools. I didn't realize that it was like the Corleone.
Except Michael didn't get pulled in.
Yes.
In this case, my father-in-law is Michael in that case. And his older brother is probably Michael. And he kind of started a legal gambling company through DC to work with the DC lottery, the oldest brother.
I got some institutional knowledge of what y'all are doing over here.
It's crazy because when I talk to my wife about her upbringing, and she tells me stories that her dad would tell her, or stories that she's heard from the family, like, her upbringing was a big ass fancy house with private schools. She did like public school up until like fourth grade. And then after that, it was all that stuff. But then I hear stories about her dad growing up where he's 12 years old and they're boarded up in the house and they gave him a gun and they sent all the women to somebody else's house. I'm like, oh, that is the Black experience in America. Yeah, like, no matter how fancy you are now, you're only a couple steps removed at all times from, you know what, the element.
Yeah, yeah. My daddy's daddy had a gun in the house, but the gun was for white folks. It was to shoot the white man off the porch when they decided that they, because apparently my daddy's daddy, he was a bad man, boy. Like, the industry in Oakdale was a hardwood mill. And so my daddy's daddy worked at the hardwood mill. And his thing was, like, your dad was on the military. His thing was, yo, man, ain't nobody gonna wind up in that mill. And that was like one of his proudest accomplishments, was that none of his kids wound up working in the mill. But he told me, man, that, you know, there was a union. Because back then, even in the South, like, you had unions. But it was Black folks and white folks working at that mill. And they would alternate, like, year after year. This year, the Black folks got the union. Like, season two of The Wire. Like, this year, it's our year to run the union. Next year, it's y'all's year to run the union or whatever. And keep in mind, my granddaddy was born in 1895, all right? But when he was the president of the union, he made them white folks come over to his house for the meetings, because normally people would not dare, and when the Black folks had control, they'd find some neutral site for the meeting, because they wouldn't dare make the white folks come over here. And no, he did. And it actually made me think of something, because when I was in grad school, one of my very good friends, my man Kirk, white dude, and I told him very early in our interactions, I'm like, look, we're going to be friends. You're going to have to come do this black shit with me too. You think about this. When you have white friends, you tend to kick it in white spaces, because white spaces are where you met them. And so you go do, I was like, nah, dog, you coming with me. I'd have him all kinds of places. And what I love, he was good. White folks tougher than people think. That's like a thing I say about Pablo. I can take Pablo anywhere. He's still going to be Pablo in the space.
My closest friend from college was from Carroll County, Maryland. Anybody from Maryland knows that Carroll County is not the place you want to be as a black dude. But he's cool as hell. He ended up marrying a black woman and moving closer to a major city. But it was the same thing where it was like, I really like you, but you got to be comfortable in all space. But he was on a football team, so he already been acclimated. But I got stuck at the beginning when you started talking about your daddy's dad. I have just envisioned him as Earl Little. Like, he's Malcolm X's father. You said he had a gun to keep the white folks off the porch. That scene pops into my head where from the movie where Earl Little, Reverend Earl Little, is on the porch bucking at the Klan in order to try to protect his family. And that's what I imagine your
Yes. I want to be clear. I'm not talking about like some hypothetical example of the white man showing up. I'm talking about the white man actually showing up.
What city was it again?
Oakdale, Louisiana.
Yeah, well, Louisiana, enough said.
Now, well, my dad tells this story, and it's in an interview, and it's really interesting. So my dad was involved in the sit-in movement in Baton Rouge when he was a student at Southern. That was a very big thing there. And he got put out of school. And the president of the school, he expected to have his back and ultimately did not. Which, you know, my dad's come to understand over time, what was he going to do when the governor said that this is what it was going to have to be? But he said that what he thought up until that point is, he was like, hey, man, I grew up with my father and we were in situations where the consequences were dire. And he was like, and I just thought you just took whatever came. That's what kind of man his pops was, right? He was like, whatever it was, he was like, oh, I just thought that whatever the other side of doing right was, that was what it was. My dad says he's gotten older, he's mellowed a little bit, he's come to understand, you know, some of the nuanced decisions that people had to make. His pops was not viewing these things through the lens of nuance. It was, I guess I got to shoot these white folks off the porch now, don't I?
I mean, and the way I hear you talk about your father, that must be incredible to hear about somebody other than your father who was even more like
yes,
strident, because the way yes, you talk about your dad is like, he ain't taking nothing.
Correct.
And he, your dad looked at his father like, he ain't taking nothing. Like, that to me is, you are just a watered down version of it at this point, because you don't find yourself in that situation.
Oh yeah, you find, you don't never hear me talk about what a gangster I am or about like what a revolutionary I am. And it's because I've met the real. Like, I've met the real deal in many forms. Although I'll tell you this, Gabe hit the music right fast.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
That is absolutely beautiful. Like, I'm sorry that the music had to be played over that. Like, I feel like that we should be at a place in the world where we don't have to play the music over that beautiful moment. And now you got me dreaming of 12 years from now.
Yes, yes.
Doing the same thing with my boy.
Like, we kind of there in New York City, but we not in that place yet. You know what I'm saying? But let me tell you, the reason I brought up the ASVAB, though, was that it's a short-term con, right? Like, these cats, they get these super 40 times. And you had a guy with a super 40 time. I'm sure that you could, like, if you put your effort into running another 4.3, you could. But that's just to run that 4.3 one time. Ain't no other time that you got to run a 40-yard dash and it actually matter. Everybody just cramming for this standardized test that really ain't telling people but so much.
Oh, yeah. That is an excellent evaluation of that situation. Is it doesn't matter that much, and you just need to do it that one day. I ran 4.3 on two separate occasions that day. I don't know that I could have run it before that day. I don't know that I could have run it after that day. And I frankly don't care, because that was the object of the day. Like, that's what I had to do that day. It got done. I was so happy. And for the rest of your career, that's why it matters so much too. It's like, if you're a type of guy who doesn't have a great kind of playing career necessarily in the first couple years or first couple stops, every team still has your tiny little placard from the draft board that they had up there. They still have that somewhere in the building, and it always says 4-3 on it. And you are going to always get a call. If you're a cornerback and it says 4-3, no matter how terrible you are, you're going to get a chance because everybody is enamored with that speed.
How did you spend draft day? Because you were a third round pick. That was day two by then, or was that still day one?
Lucky for me, it was still day one. It's before they completely stratified the draft. And we had day one was on Saturday. You had 1, 2, and 3. And then day two was on Sunday, and you'd have 4, 5, 6, 7. So I was in the compensatory picks on day one. I was pick number 97. So I almost slipped to day two.
Like, what did you do for that day? You had the crib?
Yeah, I was at the house I grew up in, and we invited a bunch of people over. We had like a draft party, but it's a weird situation because like I knew I wasn't going in the first round. I thought I could have gone in the second round. It was like an abnormally deep draft for corners that year. I know that's probably what anyone would say in that situation, but you just go back and look at it. It was like Antrell Roll, Pac-Man, Fabian Washington, Nnamdi Asomugha. Like there was a ton of talented corners. I think it was Ron Bartel, Carlos Rogers. The 05 draft was like a ton of corners. And I thought that I might go in the second round, but I knew that I was going on day one. But the reason why it's a weird experience is because you want to celebrate. You know you're going to get drafted and you want to celebrate your career and this big transition. It's like a graduation party, except the difference is everybody knows when your name is going to get called at the graduation. And everyone knows your name is going to get called in the graduation. So if you have a draft party, you're trying to celebrate all the other things, but really everyone just has an eye on the screen waiting for your name to get called. And as the night goes on, it becomes less of a party and more of a like nervous wait and watch. And so there was a bit of relief when my name got called, but the joy that you see guys jumping around, hugging the commissioner, that ain't in every room, man. That is not in every room. Most rooms is kind of like, all right, time to go to work, because that's what I felt like. All right, I'm getting on the plane tomorrow to go win a job, because third round is not a guarantee of anything.
Dog, like, anytime I see they got the cameras in the house for, like, them third round picks of them day two cats, I'm like, nah, y'all can keep that, homie. You ain't about to be watching me go through this, because it used to just be a meeting, right? Like, did you see the story that I saw came out that some guy who got drafted in 1944 had no idea he had been drafted? Because apparently he had gone and enlisted, and so he was already gone, and so he comes back, and recently he found out that he had been drafted. Now, granted, the NFL didn't pay enough money at the time to probably like stop him from going to do that, but he had no idea because the draft just, you know, granted 1944 or whatever, but the draft just wasn't the thing like that anymore. Like, I remember when Joe Thomas got drafted. You know what Joe Thomas did the day he got drafted? He went fishing with his daddy. He was the third pick in the draft. Like, there wasn't even no concern for him. I'm looking at these other cats. Like, yo, man, I guess the cell phone is messed it up because you could always go and check or whatever. But I'm like, man, if I was not like a guaranteed early pick, would it matter? What I need to be here for?
I agree. So in the Richard Sherman piece that I just wrote about the 2011 draft and about him and all that stuff, I was doing some research and looking through some old archival footage of the draft. And you got to really trust these ESPN producers if you let the cameras in your house, because I've never considered those cameras are always rolling. Like, they just pick and choose what they want to put on. So like, I didn't go through all of the footage, but I stumbled across a few different players. Richard wasn't a big enough player to have the camera in his hotel room when he was waiting to get drafted. But there was a lot of footage, hours of footage of guys sitting in that room. And if someone would scour that footage, I'm sure they could find some real embarrassing moments where people are frustrated, disappointed, yelling, fighting, doing whatever. And we had it in the draft a couple years ago, right? Or was it last year's draft where we had a couple awkward moments where we had the beef between Black Mama and White Girlfriend? Isn't that,
that was all time. That was all time great. She was doing too much, though. Like, she was trying to make sure that she was in the camera shot. And that was Isaiah Wilson. And Mama was like, you will not be in the camera shot.
You got to understand, is she's going to the league too.
Well, did she make it to the league?
Maybe she got cut, but in that moment, she like, man, competition about to step up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In that moment, she was going to the league, but being the girlfriend on draft day is like being a third round pick. There's exactly. No guarantee that there is a roster spot waiting for you.
That's my point. I didn't mean she's actually going to the league with him. I mean, she is advancing to a higher level of competition. Like, not to suggest that he doesn't have to compete for her too. Like, that's not what I'm trying to say. But we all, I mean, who knows? But we all understand that things change. I know I did. I broke up with my college girlfriend a couple weeks before I went to Denver. I was like, let's go ahead and end this now. Let's start with this charade.
Yeah, like, I mean, he might have had to compete for her. Don't get me wrong, but I saw that video. She seemed to be the competitor. Yeah, see, I want to see the video, like, with the camera there all day long, and the kinfolk or whoever there that's like, me and John gonna take a walk. We'll be back. Because you be there all day long. Them cats been sitting there like, I was trying to hold on to this until he got drafted so we could celebrate, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, hey, mama, we gonna take a walk. We just need some fresh air. That's all. Just need some fresh air.
Real relax when you get back.
Yeah, then you come back and see all the cousins with the shades on, you know, that's in there. But now I always say, man, if I was getting drafted, I would try to find something else to do that day, because I just imagine it has to be incredibly nerve-wracking, especially because there's so many factors and so many positions. So, like, if you a DB, like I always say, like, oh, man, they predicted this guy would be taken in the top five, and he went number 15. But so you were the number two edge rusher instead of the number one edge rusher. It's not really that big of a fall, but it's 10 minutes between picks.
Yeah, that is a tough situation. And then all the different breaks is like, you could come out in a draft that's loaded at a particular position, or you can come out in a year where people don't need what you're providing necessarily, and you could get lucky and move up and move back. But you're right. I don't remember being nervous or it being nerve-wracking, but I remember it should have been. I just remember being like, after we got through the second round, I was like, all right, man, I'm upset at this point because I thought I would go higher. Then we get towards the end of the third round, and I'm like, whatever, well, wherever I go, somebody gonna lose their job. I'm turning into intense focus. And then the moment, I think you'll like this story. A lot of people will like this story. We might get the angry blogs or the dog emojis out after this one. So I'm not the guy who remembers everyone who was drafted ahead of me and hates them. I remember some of them, but there is one that I always remember. He's in the media now. A guy named Dustin Fox was number 37 from Ohio State. And the Minnesota Vikings drafted him.
Hold on. Why are you leaving out the detail?
I'm not leaving it out. They can Google it if they want to. they can find out.
Okay, I'll let you keep going.
So all the guys that were going ahead of me, I was like, I'm better than him. But I wasn't mad. And then the Vikings took a corner named Dustin Fox. And I was like, oh, nah. Now this has gone too far. Dustin was of a fairer pigment than me.
They took a white corner over you. You ran a 4.3 and they took the white corner.
Disrespectful. Like, I understand why people might think that that is not a disrespectful thing to do. And I personally believe that there are lots of white slot receivers that could play corner in the NFL. But NFL people don't think that. There are zero white corners in the league. Like, Jason Seahorn is a name you remember because he the only one. It's for real 99.8% over the last decade plus black corners. Like, you got half of Courtland Finnegan and that about it. And these Minnesota Vikings looked up at a draft board and was like, we need a corner. You know who we want? Dustin Fox. The names, no, maybe they got mixed up because the names were close. Like Fox first.
D Fox.
Yeah, look at the 4.3 black dude, because we've seen that work. Nah, they slapped me in the face, damn Vikings.
I was actually wondering if there was the one guy, right? You know, because like anybody go, like, you don't start getting heated until they start being like, oh, okay, you can't be serious. And I had not thought about Dustin Fox being in that draft. And he wound up being the guy.
I mean, I thought I was better than everybody. I mean, I remember Antrell Roll coming out and he was one of the top guys. And I was like, they're going to move him to safety. Don't even draft him as a corner. They draft him as a corner, super high. Eventually, he moved to safety. I looked at everybody else and found a way to be better than Ron Bartel was out of Howard. And I was like, man, Howard, he wasn't playing nobody. Like, I had reasons in my mind while I was better than everybody. I worked out with Fabian. I was like, yeah, Fabian can fly, but he can't cover like me. Like this, I had reasons for everybody. I didn't have a reason for Dustin Fox because I didn't think I needed one.
All you had was the reason.
That's enough. I was shocked and appalled. It worked against me.
I don't know. I would have had a hard time being your cousin at that moment when they put the white corner on the screen. There's no way that we not giving you the blues about that. Like, y'all going home now. I don't even know why we here.
I think that they probably would have if they couldn't feel the tension of the situation. Because you can give people the blues sometimes, but if you give it to them at the wrong time, maybe nobody knew. Because I wasn't as engaged in the party at that point. It's like, all right, I'm tired. Because it's a long day. Everybody showed up there before the first round, and they just hanging around.
And you don't want to hang out with all of them. Like, there's some obligatory invitations under those settings. Like, this is like inviting people to your wedding, except there's not a cap on the head count.
Most of the invitations were obligatory. Most of them were like my parents' friends. My friends were somewhere else, either getting drafted before me or hoping they were going to get drafted. You can't really invite your teammates to a draft party.
Right.
Because that's like a whole different implication. So that's where my friends were. I had a couple of my friends from high school who were there, but mostly it was like my parents' friends hanging around and like my high school coach, stuff like that.
We were talking a little bit earlier about this. Shout out to ESPN, because this network has taken this draft and turned it into something that done got so much money for so many people. Yeah. For no good reason, right? Like, I don't feel like I'm messing up the hustle because it's so ingrained in this. But you have to realize this used to just be a meeting, right? They get together, they decide what players were going to go to what teams, and then they would go from there. And then Mel Kiper got some advice from Ernie Accorsi, and he figured out that I can put out this information, and there is a demand for this. And there was such a demand for it that we really got like 15 different Mel Kipers all over the place. All kinds of dudes just sitting at their crib and decide, I'm going to be a draft analyst. And now they can get to all 22 off of the sites and they can go through and they can do all these things. And everybody's getting money. Everybody's getting money off of this, right, Mel? Todd getting money. A lot of ancillary people around it then get money. Now everybody at every network, they got their draft dudes. And so they wind up out here getting money. All of this. And when the draft comes, they're like, yo, this guy's falling in the draft. The draft ain't even started. How you falling and it ain't even started?
We got risers and fallers already. It hasn't even started. The whole story about Mel is incredible. I mean, he doesn't get credit for creating this entire industry, but he certainly deserves a lot of it. I don't know if they got a Hall of Fame for people like that, but Mel need to be the first inductee.
Yeah, have you met Mel?
Oh, yeah, many times. He's from Baltimore.
That's right,
yeah,
he's from Baltimore. You see, I have not actually met Mel, but I am amazed that he sits up there. Like, we talk about this with me on TV. I did not realize this, but I typically don't do podcasts or TV with any sort of notes. Like, I'm just going to come out here and I'm going to say whatever it is. And I'll be like, oh, I wonder about this. And I might look it up on the fly or whatever, but like, I'm willing to do that. Mel is out there the same way, except there ain't no, I'm not sure about this part. You rattle off any name from anybody in the draft, even the cats they ain't got no B-roll for, right? The dudes that they don't have video for, they just like, well, I guess Mel's going to carry us. And every time, Mel carry it through. People get on Mel about the times that he gets it wrong. Well, I mean, the people who like actually get paid to do this, they get it wrong too. But Mel knows a line or two about every single player in that draft.
You can go back multiple years, too. Like, in those kind of off-the-cuff conversations, we've been on Get Up a bunch of times recently together, and we'll make a reference to a player, and Mel will be like, yeah, that's just like 1987. This guy went in the third round. Like, it's something in his brain that is built for this. Because I think, obviously, you and I both have the, like, mental horsepower to do what Mel does. But I don't know that we have that type of stamina and curiosity. Because Mel starts projecting these players. If you were studying the draft from the end of this year's draft to the start of next year's draft, you would be able to do what Mel does. But I don't think you can do that. I know I can't.
You got to go back farther than that, man. Mel's on these dudes when they juniors in high school.
That's fair. That is like Mel. There's a few articles out about how Mel is a unique guy and how he watches. This was a funny little note. Every Friday, Dallas used to come on when Mel was young. Friday at 9 o'clock, I guess. So every Friday now, Mel watches a DVD copy of a Dallas episode at 9 o'clock. Like, that is a unique type of dude. And every morning he has pumpkin pie with fat-free whipped cream on it. Like, that is the mind of a unique person where it's like, we got to find something for you to focus on. Otherwise, we're going to have to worry about you for other reasons. So praise Jesus for Ernie Accorsi sending Mel towards this draft prep stuff.
By the way, for you kids, back in the day, there used to be this television show called Dallas, and it was about this family who was, it was in oil business, right? And it was brothers, like it was JR and Bobby is the two that I remember. And it was once a really big deal because somebody shot JR and the whole thing was building up to who shot JR. You can go look it up. It was huge. It was all over the place. Like, I love the idea that Mel is still watching Dallas.
How big was Dallas? Was Dallas kind of like, if to people who don't remember Dallas, like I don't remember Dallas, but I was old enough to know the Who Shot JR reference. Is it tantamount to like Game of Thrones? The way that Game of Thrones was building up that final season, was the Who Shot JR episode the same level of intensity? I guess we're around the same age.
Guess how many people around the world watched the Who Shot JR episode?
Man, 4 million.
350 million people.
So yes, is the answer.
Yeah. Like back, especially, you know, back when we only had four channels, you know what I'm saying? But Who Shot JR had all the people watching it. People were really captivated by trying to figure out who shot JR.
Did you have a video game? I assume you had some sort of video game system when you were a little boy. Channel 3 means something entirely different to us than it means to these kids today. I was thinking about that. If I told some young kid today, oh, you better turn that thing to Channel 3. Like, to me, that's where you go watch VCR. That's where you go play your video games. They don't know nothing about Channel 3.
Yeah, well, there was also Channel 4, because on the back of the joint, you could do it to Channel 3 or Channel 4. Because, see, Houston was interesting because there was not a Channel 3 in Houston, but there was a Channel 3 in Bryan, which is not close, but had a pretty strong signal. So Channel 3 could come through kind of funny if you live far enough north. So I would switch mine over to the Channel 4. You had to run it through the box, and the box ran through the TV, and you had to put it on a channel, and then you turn it on a channel, then you turn on the Nintendo.
Did you have, I guess this might have been the antennas, where there was a screw on the back.
Yes.
And you had like this little fork-shaped thing that you had to like
yes.
put around a screw and screw it in. Like those are, I'm old, man.
These kids don't know, man. Yeah. They don't know nothing about that fall. They don't know about them bunny ears. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't understand the life that we was out here living just to play some video game action, you know? If you wanted to play a game against your friend, guess what your friend had to do? Come to your house.
It was a big deal, yeah. And we would have 10 friends over my boy Justin's house, had all the game systems. He was the first one to get GoldenEye. We have 10 friends over there with 4 controllers. And you had to have like a high score to stay on, just passing it around. Like, that was a different experience. That was fun. And the rest of us would go outside and play basketball till it was our turn all summer long. Oh, the memories.
Man, all of that, man. Just like, you actually had to hang out with your friends. And I don't mean to say that like such a pejorative way, but like, I was looking at that Floyd Mayweather, Logan Paul situation. And there's a generation that doesn't really value elite athleticism with like the wonder that we do. Like the idea that there's a whole bunch of kids who would rather watch somebody play 2K than watch an NBA basketball game. Now, part of it is the self-absorption where they're like, oh, okay, maybe I could one day become the video game guy. So that's the reason why they watch it. But I guess part of it, though, like to really appreciate athletics and all that stuff, you got to hang out with people. Because, like, really playing games involves being around people. Maybe that's what, you know, how we get to this.
I guess. I don't watch a lot. I don't watch any, like, streamers, video game streamers. But I guess those guys are entertaining, right? Like, they are the most popular guys, have, like, a gimmick and, like, jokes. And I would assume that's why you're tuning in. You aren't just tuning in to watch them play the game, because I don't care about hanging out with people or not. Like, there's no way watching Cyber LeBron is better than watching actual LeBron.
If you watching people play video games, go read a book. This is just something I can't relate to.
I can't relate to it either, but you're making the assumption that watching somebody playing video games is at the bottom of their stack. You're saying that like, if you have made it to watching video games, you probably need to read a book or go outside. Like, no, they haven't gone through all the TV series and all the movies to made it here. Like, watching people play video games, for the people who watch people play video games, like, that's at the top. They haven't yet made it to watching TV. Maybe they don't need to go outside. They just need to make different choices, or we just need to accept that we are washed in that particular category.
Yeah, but you know what, though? If this is what being washed is, it's like the inverse. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm washed, but you lazy. How that come down? Like, again, I just can't. Like, when Myers Leonard threw it all away because he was playing video games, and got out here and referred to somebody by, I believe, an anti-Semitic slur. He's Myers Leonard, right? Like, you're not even talking about watching De'Aaron Fox play video games. Like, before we even get to, like, LeBron or Kawhi or Giannis, you watching Myers Leonard play video games. I don't care how good at video games he is. I just can't see that.
He should have been in trouble for what he did, but it should be an indictment of all the people that are watching it. Like, you ain't had nothing better to do with your time than to watch Myers Leonard probably poorly play some video games and spit out some anti-Semitic remarks.
Dog, there's so many streams crossing there, right?
So many streams crossing.
But I do want people to check it out. Dominic Foxworth wrote a great story on Richard Sherman and the 2011 draft, which when you go back and look at it, all-time great draft, except for the people that reach for quarterbacks. Like, there's a whole run of that draft where everybody either got a good player or a bad quarterback.
That draft, I think 1981 is like a famed defensive draft, and then that 2011 draft probably has three surefire Hall of Famers, a few other maybes, and also like a ton of good players, great players, but it was an incredible draft. And Richard Sherman is, in my view, the most interesting of all those kind of big name players because he went so late.
Right. So surefire Hall of Famers, I would say Richard Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
I think Julio has moved into that place.
Yeah.
And Von Miller.
Right. That's the three right. I was thinking also.
Right. So like if we were looking at surefire Hall of Famers, that's who we're talking about. But then you do stuff like you go down to the third round and you get Justin Houston, DeMarco Murray, and Jarrell Casey, right? And it's like, oh, wait, what are you guys? You just go to the second round. Colin Kaepernick pops up there, right? And then the first round, these are all the dudes who have made the Pro Bowl.
I mean, J.J. Watt, I think, is...
Oh, yeah, my bad. That's a guarantee.
Right. And Patrick Peterson, I think, is going to go. I think it's better than 50% that he goes. Those other names are 100%.
Yeah, like Cam Newton's not going to go to the Hall of Fame, but he's still Cam Newton, right? A.J. Green might go to the Hall of Fame, but he's still A.J. Green. Alton Smith could have gone to the Hall of Fame, but you read the news. Tyron Smith, I don't know if he's got enough media backing, right? But that's a Hall of Fame caliber player. Robert Quinn, who I still can't believe nobody's made a movie about. Mike Pouncey. Ryan Kerrigan, Cam Jordan, Mark Ingram, Cam Hayward. That's just the first round, guys.
That's just the first round. Oh, man. Then everybody's favorite, Turkey Bacon Dalton at 35 in the second round. I should probably stop doing that. I shouldn't do that anymore. Ryan Clark had a phenomenal joke a year ago.
He's Turkey Bacon. Like, you know you need something.
It was such a good joke, and I loved it so much. I had never forgotten it because one of my homeboys, Muslim guy, reached out to me and said that it was a good joke. It hit him, even though he's Muslim, and he only eats turkey bacon. But I feel bad about doing that to Andy Dalton repeatedly. But yeah, he was a multiple-time Pro Bowler and a starting quarterback in the NFL, so he wasn't one of those quarterbacks that you reached on and considered a bust.
Nah, dude, there were two really good undrafted guys in that draft. Doug Baldwin and Chris Harris.
Doug Baldwin, I didn't realize this until I started doing this story. He was their best receiver as an undrafted rookie. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Who does that? That is incredible. I mean, that's a testament to him, and it's also a testament to how true Pete Carroll and John Snyder were to their philosophy, because everyone says best players play. We're going to compete. They was really about that life down there.
Yeah.
Like, they was really cutting big-time dudes and just had a bunch of young, hungry, undrafted and like late drafted guys on that team. And that's what built that team. It's crazy because John Snyder gets a lot of credit. He deserves it for finding some gems late in the draft. But when you look at that defense, it's more to me about mentality and all the intangibles, why they were so good, than it is about talent. And those guys had talent, but you compare them to the 2000 Ravens or the 85 Bears, like other greatest defenses of all time. Both of those teams, all their starters were picked and the first 38 picks, except for four guys. Both those teams had the same thing. The 2013 LOB Seahawks, they had two players picked in the first round. Everybody, and then Bobby Wagner in the second round. Everybody else was third round deeper or undrafted on that defense. And they compare favorably, frankly, to some of the greatest defenses of all time.
They got everybody for the cheap. Like, they got Michael Bennett as a free agent for the cheap. Even Earl Thomas, who's a first-round pick and definitely a Hall of Famer, but, I mean, that's still the relative cheap, right? They got it done with him while he was on his first deal. Brandon Browner, they scraped off the scrap heap.
Yep.
Cam Chancellor was like a fifth-round pick.
Canadian League, Brandon Browner came from Canada. I had one training camp with B. Browntown in Denver. He didn't make the team, but he ended up leaving the NFL at that moment owing the league money because they don't pay you nothing during training camp. But the fine schedule is the same. He had an in-game penalty, got smacked with a fine, didn't get paid enough to cover it before they cut him. So this man may be the only player to leave the league in the red. Fortunately for him, he went to Canada, made a name for himself there, and came back in and made some good money with the Seahawks. And then the rest of his story is pretty tragic.
You know what? Good time to wrap this thing up. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week, including Foxworth Fridays. Dominique Foxworth, thank you. There we go. Gabe Bassane and Tony Collette, you and handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.